the kids love? You too. And this is maybe my favorite anecdote about this phase of BlackBerry history, because there's this scene where Mike Lazaridis actually goes and is like walking down the beach with Bono, and they're trying to arrive at the best philosophy for what their ad campaign is going to be. And this is what they come up with.
Is it just like a generic U2 video? It's not even on a roof or anything. It's in a black void.
Here comes the slogan.
Oh. BlackBerry loves U2.
What?
Not that necessarily the other way around, I guess.
That was the slogan?
I mean, this...
I'm glad BlackBerry has its own taste and preference. It's not very good taste.
I just gotta say here, BlackBerry Loves U2 was a massive international ad campaign. The central concept of the celebrity endorsement is U2 loves BlackBerry. Like, that's what you're paying for. You're paying for the celebrity to say that they love your product.
Wait, was this like a double entendre where it's like, BlackBerry loves you?
Is that what they must have thought they were being clever. BlackBerry loves you, too.
Apparently, they just talked about how what this is really about is love, and we love you, you two, and maybe that's what this campaign is about. And it's cheesy for Bono to say, I love BlackBerry, but we just want people to know that you love you too, the band? So do we.
It is okay.
I do not like U2, but I have to respect Bono because that mother then turned around and did a deal with Apple.
Yeah, I remember this.
And Alicia
when
Keys.
When they put the album on every single iPod, it was so annoying.
Bono gets paid.
But the Alicia Keys thing famously, remember, she was, on Twitter, you could see the metadata for tweets and how people are tweeting. So Alicia Keys, the global brand ambassador for BlackBerry, was tweeting from an iPhone. That was the thing I remember.
That's amazing.
Being pointed out at the time.
They were toast. There was no out-appling Apple. There was no celebrity that was going to fix it for them. They were done for. And that brings me to my own pet theory about why they blew it. Our final theory. The Canada of it all. It's not really my theory. This is a theory that appeals to me. I can't take credit for it. I first read this from Michael Geist. And here I bring you back to that point that I highlighted earlier about how that original genius stroke of theirs was just like making the data as like literally conservative. They were conserving bandwidth. They were conserving, everything was conservative. It was conservative use of space on the device for it to be the right size. It was a machine built to fit within the tight constraints of Canada's shitty telecom networks. Slow, expensive cellular data, super expensive texting fees. But here came a device that would let you do a workaround. You don't have to spend money on how many texts you're going to. Remember, we used to have to pay for texts. So you got this many texts a month. It would deliver push email with the smallest amount of data transferred possible. This was not some flashy, colorful American device. This was not an entertainment machine promising you video games and videos, not trying to be the best calendar, or calculator, clock, everything. No, it's a portable email machine that just works, conservative, constrained. It was built to cope with scarcity. So that was a Canadian invention. Steve Jobs was an American, and his strategy was, F you. I am not going to shrink down my vision. I am not going to shrink down the data so it fits on your highway, AT&T, Verizon. I'm going to give people what they want, and the people will speak, and they will use, and they will demand, and their oversized demands will force the old guard to build bigger highways. Like, the cellular providers will have to create more bandwidth to accommodate because the consumer wants what the consumer wants. I think it is wrong to ask, why did BlackBerry blow it? How did BlackBerry blow it? I think the better question is, like, how did they even have it to begin with? Like, that is the unique thing, that there was this moment, this quirk of history, a weird glitch in time, when Canadianness was actually a competitive feature and not a bug. And the constraints of our mentality actually put us very briefly ahead of the curve. But the empire was always going to strike back. It was always going to happen. And Apple, remember, they already had the iPod. They had already created this incredible consumer device that people just loved. And ultimately, this fight that everybody likes to perceive, and there's like a season of business wars of iPhone versus BlackBerry. And then it's true, BlackBerry tried to fight iPhone. You know who ultimately killed it for them? Because even after the iPhone came up, they were still booming in international markets, and they still had years of growth ahead of them. Mm-hmm. Who ultimately drank their milkshake? It was Google.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
The ultimate ninja move comes from Android a few years later when they get an app store. And by then, Verizon's like, yeah, sure, you can have an app store. And Google says, that's great. And guess what? The 30% cut that we take from selling apps on our app store, you can have that. Here, just go take it. Here's some free money. Mm-hmm. Go nuts, Verizon. So suddenly you're handing the telcos not only a huge chunk of free money, but you're also giving them an incentive to put Androids everywhere. And that really killed BlackBerry's business. And BlackBerry could not have anticipated that. That was a totally disruptive move. And remember, because the market for apps was so shut down to the handset makers, Rimmed never really had to worry about having apps any more complicated than things that work perfectly well for enterprise customers or these, you know, ringtones and brickbreaker games for consumers. And suddenly the world opens up and you have Apple and Google, who are software companies and work with app developers, waltzing in with a ready-made market, a crew of developers ready to put instant apps out there. And BlackBerry does not have that.
Wait, so BlackBerry didn't really buy into apps as a concept. Like, were they sourcing different app developers for their phones?
Oh, my God, it was a nightmare.
Tell us what you recall.
So basically, yeah, BlackBerry had its own operating system, remember? Like, that's, and you had to develop an iOS app, you had to develop an Android app, you had to develop a BlackBerry app. So a BlackBerry Classic, my previous phone, ran on this BB10 system. And you could see the apps giving up on it, Twitter, Facebook, you could see them giving up on it one by one as they would either stop rolling out updates or do what Facebook did, which is the latest update literally just deletes the app and replaces it with a link to the Facebook website on your home screen.
They just stopped bothering.
Yep, they just stopped bothering.
Well, Apple and Google had a huge head start in the whole concept of like inviting other developers to play on there. I mean, I think BlackBerry's whole thing was like, this is ours, our server, secure. You know, I think they were really ill-prepared to create something that an API lets developers just...
Is there any way they could have actually won here?
Yes and no. Like, I don't think that there was any path whatsoever to this fight of, like, BlackBerry beating the iPhone. But Jim Balsillie actually realized that pretty early. And he wanted to do what you're supposed to do, which is pivot, right? In a very dramatic and dynamic way, he was ready to abandon RIM's core business, or at least really underserve it, and pivot into the future. And he saw the future. He thought the future of the company was not in handsets. It was going to be in BBMs.
What's BBM?
That was a messaging platform, instant messaging.
His last stand as RIM's leader was a plan to radically reorient the business away from hardware and towards instant messaging. And here again, a very conservative and Canadian mindset. We still have this thriving handset business. It's actually on the way up in international markets. We still have all these old guys in suits who are like, I'm not giving up my BlackBerry. I don't need this iPhone. That's our business. We need to double down on that. And Lazaridis was like still, I think, in an engineering mindset, like, I still need to beat the iPhone. Like, he was still trying to make a better BlackBerry. So here's like this incredibly complicated challenge for Lazaridis and the rest of the company to try to actually out iPhone the iPhone. And here's Balsillie saying, no, just as our original killer app was just like email on demand on the go, here's this super simple thing we have and we have a head start with, and that's what we should double down on. He saw the future.
Another thing that's forgotten now is how popular BBM was. BBM was the forerunner of Signal and WhatsApp, and arguably could have beaten them all if they had taken some different strategic choices. It's one of the greatest challenges companies encounter. You know, once you get something that works and makes a lot of money, it becomes the thing you try to protect, even if protecting it in the long term is not the right choice for the business. BlackBerry certainly encountered that in the early 2010s when BlackBerry device sales were in a free fall. And Jim Balsillie had this idea, let's go all in on BBM and make it available on every other phone. And there was a strong countercurrent of the company that was like, well, no, if we do that, we'll threaten BlackBerry sales even more. Well, guess what? BlackBerry sales went to zero. And if they had done the strategy, who knows, maybe they could have stemmed the tide and become the one WhatsApp going forward. And look how valuable WhatsApp became. So sometimes trying to protect the golden goose is probably a sensible short-term strategy and a disastrous long-term one. And it's super difficult to know how to navigate that because you have to answer to a board of directors. You have to answer to shareholders.
What's interesting is that like the concept of BBM actually would have been an amazing app that could have been used across different types of phones and different networks. But the fact that they wanted to keep it to BlackBerry was the problem. Like it could have been Signal. It could have even been like an early Slack. but it's not because they kept it to BlackBerry.
Yeah, they were locked into the idea that they were the makers of things. And as we discussed this, well, just last week, Sean Silkoff in the Globe and Mail reports BlackBerry exploring potential breakup of company.
Right, so BlackBerry still exists.
It's still worth billions of dollars.
So how are they making money then?
If I recall Silkoff's article, it's like this car operating system called QNX that they acquired at one point and patents. So that seems to be where a lot of it comes from.
If you trace back the origins of some of the biggest technologies, there are Canadian roots, you know, Corel, which Photoshop and all the graphic software, Nortel, even like eBay, YouTube has Canadian roots, but nobody seems to be able to actually keep the company in Canada and create something like an Apple.
Except for Pornhub. Still in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Except for Pornhub.
And Shopify.
And Shopify.
So, I mean, you keep saying they blew it, but aren't these guys all still mega wealthy?
Oh, they are both ridiculously rich.
He's spending most of his time on a yacht these days. A big yacht. Like, you're not going to believe. I don't know exactly, but I think Jim's a billionaire. And I think Mike's quite wealthy, too. But I don't exactly know, because you don't exactly know when they sold.
What is Jim up to these days?
He is very interested in Arctic exploration. The Franklin Expedition shipwreck thing that Stephen Harper was very excited about, Peter Mansbridge and them. He put a lot of money into that. He's become a fierce advocate for funding tech in Canada, and he's always got editorials about how we're doing it wrong. Ottawa's got to do it this way and not that way. I think that that's, if his legacy is not going to be the inventor of the smartphone that changed the world, it's going to be actually a very Canadian legacy. And it's not without some credibility. Like, I think that both of them really invested in Canada having a vibrant tech sector. And, they've invested in other companies that have done very well. Jim's made money on other companies. And it's true that in the Waterloo region, they created like a tech scene. Mm-hmm. Nothing to the scale of what they did. I think Mike's whole quantum computing thing has basically fizzled out and he's off on his yacht. So I'm not sure that he's really putting as much work as Jim is these days into keeping things alive in Canada. So that's it. That's your Canada Land episode. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read them all. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is at canadaland.com. This episode was produced by Bruce Thorson, our senior producer, along with Tristan Capicchione, our audio editor and technical producer. We had assistance this week from Cherise Suturin and Jonathan Goldsby. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive. Journalist Karen Pugliese, in between jobs at the moment. Perhaps you'll have some news for our listeners about that soon. Hello.
Hello. Good morning, Jesse Brown.
The press has been reporting for years the name of a prominent and powerful man who was accused of abusing many Indigenous kids. But now it is suddenly illegal for us to say his name. Weird. Welcome back to Shortcuts, Karen, where we talk shit about the news.
Thank you, Jesse.
Survivors of a day school in Burns Lake, British Columbia, have long awaited a Canadian Human Rights Tribunal into their allegations of abuse. This has been a long time coming for some of these survivors. What do they hope the outcome will be?
Yeah, you're right. It has been many years of waiting to tell their story. They hope that, of course, the commission chair, who's called a member, will find in their favor that the RCMP did do a half-hearted investigation, as they allege, and believed that they were lying, that, of course, that the particular teacher they've accused could never be an abuser. They feel that the RCMP brought those biases into the investigation.
So, Karen, there's a story that your former newsroom APTN is reporting on there and that we've reported on over the years, and that the Globe and Mail and the TIE and everybody else has reported on for 10 years. And I think that listeners will be familiar with this, a lot of them, when I talk about the allegations of child abuse from one individual who is now a very powerful and influential man, who many people say, at this point, there are dozens of people who say that when he was their teacher at the Immaculata Day School for Indigenous Kids in Burns Lake, he subjected them to racist verbal abuse, beatings, according to one accuser, sexual assault. And listeners will know who I'm talking about, I think, when I talk about journalist Laura Robinson, who brought the story to people's attention in the Georgia Strait. I can go over these details, which I have shared many times, but what I can't do is something that I've done every time we've reported on the story in the past. I can't name the guy because this Canadian Human Rights Tribunal that is currently taking place in Burns Lake, 10 years after the story first broke, there's a publication ban, but I've never seen anything like this. It's like a post-publication ban. It's a very strange situation to not be able to name somebody whose name will immediately come up on Google searches for this topic. And I feel very strange as a journalist, like withholding information that is very much in the public domain at this point. Have you ever encountered like a post-publication ban before?
I don't know if there's other instances of this, but the only thing that I could think of is there were times when the police would release the name of a minor because they were searching for them either, you know, as they were involved in the crime and then retract it later. I've seen that happen once or twice, but I've really never seen anything like this. And I was listening so closely with my now newly attuned Canada Land legal ear as you were talking, because we're not allowed to say the province in which the person lives. We're not allowed to say anything about where they've worked, and we're not allowed to say anything about where they used to live. And so it's not just the name. There's these other restrictions on it. And we have to be very careful, even though you're quite right. Kathleen Martin, who we just heard reporting for APTN, did a whole documentary on Laura Robinson and this whole situation.
Yeah, we're not allowed to say any of that stuff. But the one exception is we are able to place them as somebody who worked at the Immaculata Day School. So I'm being diligent. Don't worry. I know you're not here yet, but I appreciate that you're still taking responsibility for whether I step over the line here. We report the news within the boundaries of the law here, but we don't have to like it when like these just absurd rules, like it's already too much with publication bans in Canada, and we have limitations that I don't think reporters in the States have or a lot of other places. But this is a new one because this guy is a very well-known person. I should note here that both APTN and the TIE fought this anonymity order, I guess this post-publication ban, and they lost.
Yeah, but good for them for fighting it.
But this is not him on trial here. Mm-hmm. This is a hearing in which the RCMP have to answer for their investigation.
Right.
Let's focus on that here because the RCMP are accused of failing to conduct a basic investigation before they closed the case on this suspect. So according to the human rights complaint, they did not even bother the Mounties to interview witnesses who were in a position to corroborate the allegations. The chief of Lake Babine First Nation came forward to say that he's not a witness. It happened to him, that this guy abused him too. The Mounties didn't bother to interview this guy, says the complaint. They did not bother to get warrants, production orders, to get records from the church that would tell them whether or not the suspect even worked at these schools at the time of the alleged incidents. Like that seems like a pretty basic thing in investigation, time and place. Could this have happened? Were you there? The complaint accuses the Mounties of bias. They asked one of the complainants again and again, would she take a polygraph test to prove that she wasn't lying?
11 times.
11 times. They never asked the suspect if he would take a lie detector test to, you know, back up his alibi and his denial. And then it gets even wilder. The complaint against the Mounties, like, suggests a reason why the Mounties were biased. It turns out that the Mountie who was assigned to investigate, this Corporal Mackey, his boss had a noteworthy connection to the powerful man accused. And I can't get into details because of this publication ban. But here's what happened, because the complaint includes a quote that the Mountie who's investigating sends to his suspect. Like, this is the guy he's investigating. And he sends an email to the suspect that says, you know, I was about to let everyone know that this case was closed and that we're not filing charges, but unfortunately, he writes, I'm now told a new investigative team will be looking into this. I realize you'd like to see this resolved. I'm very sorry for the delay. He's apologizing to the suspect that the suspect is going to continue to be investigated. So it seems to me like they've got a case here. Other emails between senior Mounties, internal emails between the Mounties, they're worrying to each other like, wow, if we file criminal charges, there are a lot of organizations that are going to be seriously embarrassed. And then they don't file criminal charges. So the suspect, AB, is not on trial here. But this is the closest process that the accusers are getting to justice, like a shot at justice. And in the decade that's passed since the story broke, people have died. Accusers against this guy have died waiting for this day. And here the day is, and we can't say his name.
Yeah, so I think a few things about that. Like, one of the reasons that we can't say his name, like the reason given for requesting the publication ban was that it could cause harm. You know, I think it was reputational harm, but also emotional harm. And yet all the people who are involved in making the accusations, who claim to be victims, they're all named. They aren't under a publication ban. So it's a little weirdly uneven that way.
Isn't that a thing? Like, usually in a sexual assault case, it's the victims. The court's usually very careful about protecting the identities of the alleged victim. Not that they're asking for anonymity. In fact, they've signed affidavits. They've come forward. Their names are associated with this.
So this is a human rights tribunal case, and they are asking for some sort of damages, right? And they're asking for them from the RCMP, not from the accused, who we cannot name. But mostly what they're asking for is they're asking for the RCMP to reform itself. Like, nothing's been proven yet, but they're saying, based on the fact that we think that systemic racism was a factor in how this was investigated or not investigated properly, and here's the evidence that we're putting forward that we think shows that we weren't treated fairly or entirely like reasonable human beings in this process, and the RCMP didn't do the job that it was supposed to do. Here are some recommendations of how we would like the RCMP to fix it. And I think it's really interesting. It says to me, as like sort of this impartial person witnessing this, that this is like a moral stand that I think they're taking.
I think that so much of this is about listening to people when they speak up. And I know that you're not on our dime yet, but can I ask you to help us with an editorial call? Because we had a conversation here about, like, at any juncture where we can, these accusers, some of whom have died asking to be heard. And we can't name him, but we can name them and we can hear them. This is a content warning situation, and one of these clips involves somebody describing, in general terms, sexual assault. How do you feel about us listening to the accusers now, briefly?
I'm okay with it. I think if somebody's come forward and put their story on tape, they want it to be heard.
All right, let's do that. Karen, here is one of the accusers, Kathy Woodgate. She died in 2021, but this is a clip originally broadcast on the CBC by Duncan McHugh.
It was really like a nightmare.
But former student Kathy Woodgate is one of a number of students who remember nuns and staff doling out physical and verbal abuse, particularly her former gym teacher.
He would target the slowest people, and I was one of the slowest ones, so I got hit most of the time.
And here is a clip that I will, again, include a content warning that this discusses sexual abuse of an Indigenous child. This is an account from Beverly Abraham.
He started with my legs and then putting his hand up, and he put his hand where it wasn't supposed to go, in my privates.
So those are people who wanted very much to be heard, and there are many more. I'll say, in case I didn't say it before, that AB, the accused, denies any wrongdoing completely and has not been charged with any criminal offense. It's the first time the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal has been held outside of Ottawa. This is happening in Burns Lake, BC, and then it's going to move online.
I think the legacy here is something that we've seen play out time and again with residential school survivors. It's taken so much time for these stories to come forward. And I think this case before the Human Rights Tribunal is so important in just showing how the systems themselves have kept residential school survivors from ever getting justice. I mean, clearly the case has to go forward and hear whether the RCMP did a proper investigation. The long history of mistrust of RCMP being the people who took the kids in the first place to go to residential schools, of being always on the front line when First Nations people are struggling for land rights and for their other human rights, and being the people that you face. There's so little trust there. And for the people who did talk to them and tell them their story, to then find that when the original investigation by the RCMP was reviewed, that there were so many holes in it that it wasn't done properly. The RCMP had reviewed the RCMP's investigation and found that it wasn't sufficient.
It's even worse than that. And here I think it is worth making the distinction that it's a relevant one. These are not residential school survivors. These were the day schools. And
oh, sorry, yeah.
That's okay, because I think it's relevant. But that's a bit of a loophole that a lot of people who suffered a lot of the same abuses that residential school survivors suffered, but did not find themselves entitled to the same recognition or compensation. The day schools are a part of this history that we need to reckon with as well. But you bring up an amazing point, which is like very relevant here. There were protests in Burns Lake, and the same RCMP officers who were tasked with investigating historical childhood abuse allegations of these people, some of those same people, the accusers themselves, were involved in the protests. And there was a heavy-handed, violent police response. So the same cops who were like investigating these people as protesters, who they're up against in that context, are the same cops who are like trying to determine such a personal, intimate thing, this historical alleged trauma, and this is the cop who's on the case trying to determine if you were abused as a child. Like, that's messed up. That is Shortcuts for this week. Karen, thank you for joining me. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jesse. Looking so forward to joining you and the team. I'm so excited.
Yeah, me too. We are on Twitter at CanadaLand. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. Karen, where can people find you?
Well, so long as Twitter exists, I am on there. If you can spell my last name, you can find me.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lessard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ejofor. Theme music is by So Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Thank you for supporting Canada Land.